Welcome back to How to Tickle Yourself. I'm your host, Duff McDonald, along with today's special co-host, Malcolm Fitch, who has also been a guest on this program. Why Malcolm? Well, because we're going to be talking about basketball today. Malcolm is a lifelong basketball player and fan, and Joey of Rockledge has precisely nothing to say about basketball. So I recruited my old friend to help me ask all the right questions of our guest, who I'm thrilled to tell you is Rich Cohen, my favorite writer ever. I am not exaggerating. By virtue of his mastery of the crafts of writing and storytelling, Rich, more than anyone else on this earth, has inspired me to become a better writer and storyteller myself. And he just keeps doing it. Whenever a new Rich Cohen book comes out, it's like Christmas around here. I'm going to give you a short list of Rich Cohen books you should go look at if you want some good reading. Five of my favorites are Tough Jews, The Fish That Ate the Whale, The Adventures of Herbie Cohen, Sweet and Low, and The Last Pirate of New York. And that's not even mentioning his sports books. Rich Cohen has written for The Cycle, with a book about football, about the Chicago Bears, one about baseball, about the Chicago Cubs, one about hockey, about his son's hockey team. That one's called Pee Wee's, and it captures the insanity of being a sports parent brilliantly. And now he's back with a book about basketball. Rich's latest is called When the Game Was War, the NBA's Greatest Season. He's talking about 1987, and he tells the story of that season through the prism of four of the greatest players in NBA history: Magic Johnson, Larry Bird, Isaiah Thomas, and Michael Jordan. I read it in a single day last week, and I'm happy to report that it's amazing. It's not just the story of what happened, but also the story behind the story, which is Rich Cohen's specialty. If you like basketball or sports or just a great story told by a master storyteller, you will love this book. But enough of this from me, Rich Cohen. It is great to see you again. Congratulations on the new one. You've done it again.
Thank you so much, Duff. Very kind.
I too, Rich. I too read your book in essentially a single sitting, and hats off. It's got the broader context, and it's got gripping, you know, play by play sort of recreation. It's a masterpiece.
Ah, thank you so much.
The present moment, traveling town to town, the mystery of the motion, right here, right now, right here, right now, whoa, right here, right now.
All right. So before we get to the book, I just want to know something as a writer. How do you do this? How do you churn out a book every 18 months? What's your diet? What are you eating? What are you doing?
I think it's fear of death. I'm not kidding. Like when I was a kid, they thought I was going to just die pretty soon. So it's put this fear in me that at any second I could die. This makes life miserable for the people around me, but it makes me feel like there's a certain amount I want to get done while I'm still around, and I work as hard as I can to do it. That's it.
Jesus. All right. So you open this book and you close this book with a suggestion. You're like, this could be the greatest season ever in NBA history. However, it could also just be me.
Right.
It could be that I was 19 when this season happened. And it could be that when you're 19, everything seems like the most important thing of all time. You talk about at the end that you've surveyed all sorts of people, including the players, coaches, and whoever, what is the greatest season? What did you eventually conclude? Is it the greatest, or is it just Rich Cohen's greatest?
I mean, I think it's the greatest. And if not the greatest, anybody would agree that it's right up there as one of the two or three greatest seasons for various reasons, mostly because you had four of the great dynasties existing at the same time, all in different states of coming and going. and more future Hall of Famers at any one time. And it was a great moment for the sport. It was a moment where the sport really exploded. And you had sort of just ascending was the Bulls, Michael Jordan's Bulls. So I sort of pitched it as the Game of Thrones on the hard court, you know, because you don't really know who the hero is going to be, you know, until the fullness of time. But I'm also aware of the fact that I'm now 55 and I've lived through a lot of seasons. And after a while, one starts to seem like another. And when you're young, everything seems more vibrant and more real. And when you get into conversations with younger people like my kids, they get annoyed when you say this was the greatest season because they think the moment they're living through is the greatest. And I'm also aware that my father always said sports never got better than when you had Ted Williams and Joe DiMaggio and Duke Snyder all playing baseball in New York and Boston. So I try to be aware that it could be a case of mistaken identity. I always remember this thing, a quote, a really old thing in The New Yorker, where H.G. Wells wrote a book before the First World War where he said the world is coming to an end, or maybe it's before the Second World War, the world is coming to an end. And E.B. White had written, it's a case of mistaken identity. Something's coming to an end, because H.G. Wells was like, you know, 90 years old. But in looking back on it, H.G. Wells is also right, because it was right before the Second World War and the world did kind of come to an end. So they both have their point.
Malcolm.
Rich, I love the, I felt like you had written this book for me. So quick background. I'm roughly your age, grew up in Massachusetts, the kid brother of a very, very good basketball player. I played all throughout my youth. Our shared bedroom was literally covered all walls and the ceiling with, cutouts from the newspaper of Larry Bird, with one exception, which was, I believe my brother spotted at least the first photograph of Michael Jordan that anyone had ever seen. And so in the sea of Larry Bird, there was one little Michael Jordan photo from him in high school, I think. So, you know, I spent years and years absolutely devoted to the NBA. And the Celtics in particular, but you know, I watched every Celtics playoff game this year, and did nothing but complain to my children as we watched the games together that the game is different. Yeah, and it's nowhere near as captivating. One notable thing about your book is you sort of steer clear of that criticism of the current NBA. How do you feel? Do you like understanding? There's the adoration you had of the game as a young man, but what do you just think about the NBA today?
I mean, I do think that it's a completely different game, and it's because of the 3-point shot, really, which changes everything. And what's interesting is Larry Bird's first game was also the first game in which a 3-point shot was made.
Yeah.
So his year was the beginning of the 3-point shot. And what happened is for a long time, the 3-point shot existed as it was intended, which was as a way to sort of make a team have a fighting chance when they were down by 10 points and there was a minute left or whatever. They can make three, you know, we saw Reggie Miller, I don't know if you remember, do that to the Knicks in 1 year in the playoffs. Yeah. And otherwise, it was not really that important of a shot. And sometime, I kind of think it's connected to the computers and the algorithms. Somebody figured out statistically that you're better off shooting all threes and making 30% of them than shooting a range of shots and making 60% of them, you would win. And as a result, teams started to put everybody in the outside. And now when you watch the game, it's just a different game, because especially this season, everybody was gathered under the basket to fight for the rebound. And the fight for the rebound was itself a game within a game. Dennis Rodman's whole career was based on that. Larry Bird was a great rebounder. And now it's not just that, you know, they're taking the 3-point shot, but that when you miss a 3-point shot, it's a completely different kind of rebound, right, where the ball goes way outside and it's got to have a different game. So unintentionally, the nature of the game was changed, and it's just a different game where I do not like it as much. And I find it less intense and less exciting, but I'm careful about saying it because I know that everybody tends to like the game they grew up with. I grew up as a Chicago Bulls fan, when the Bulls were getting beaten silly by the Pistons every year, admiring the Pistons, because my father, who'd been a basketball coach, said the Pistons are playing something he recognized as Brooklyn basketball, which is you can make the layup over me, but you're going to pay a very hefty price for it. In our case, meant my father was going to drive his teenage son into the garage door and leave him crumpled on the driveway.
That's right. So clearly the three-point shot has affected the offenses. I have a hypothesis I'd love to bounce off of you and get your reaction to it. So I think it affects the fans, right? I mean, when back in the mid-90s and certainly earlier periods and other periods as well, you as a fan could see a team totally locked in together, you know, sort of the mind meld, flow state kind of thing happening. And you could see that mind meld lasts, you know, several plays a quarter. Like there would be these long stretches. And just because of the three-point shot, it's like, yes, some of them go in and it's streaky and great, everyone feels good. But it's really hard to see teams play in the same way that they used to. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a little bit like watching a carnival thing where people are just trying to get the ball in that little basket at the carnival, you know? And the fact is no team was better at what you're talking about. Well, they all were of that era, but really the Celtics. Because when you watch the Celtics of that era play, when they had Bill Walton on that team and they had all those guys, they always made it seem like more passes than was completely necessary because it was fun. So you see like Larry Bird basically have the shot go up, look like he's going to take it and pass to Walton, who then scored. Not even necessary, but that was the game that they were playing. It was about almost like a Globetrotters-like thing where they were moving down the floor as a five-man unit and making these unexpected passes. It was like geometry of all these hidden angles. And now everybody's pushed out to the three-point line and it's one or two people kind of running through the paint, and that's completely gone. And that's what made the game exciting and beautiful and super, super cool. And obviously the Lakers of Showtime really did that. And the Bulls got good when they figured out how to do it, when they got all the players that they needed. And then the fact is that because the Pistons found the way to stop that, which they had to do against the Celtics, and they did it by shutting down on defense and being very rough and very violent, that resulted in all kinds of rule changes, which changed the nature of defense, where now, you know, the defense doesn't exist as we would have recognized it, because half the stuff that they do is a penalty. So they don't do it. And that's interesting to me because that's not only in basketball. Basketball's less physical sport. So are all the major sports. You know, they're all less physical. So it's kind of a change in the America in general, which is we've sort of gone all icing and no cake. I mean, there's just not a lot of patience for exciting defense.
There's a great line. There's a great line in the book, and it's apropos of what you just said here. You're talking about the different teams evolving, and you said, so here, through a rent in the fabric, you can see NBA history in motion. The Celtics evolved to beat the 76ers, who had evolved to beat the Lakers, who had evolved to beat an earlier iteration of the Celtics. History is not a line, it's a pattern. It's a beautiful sort of insight as to how a league can evolve over time, sort of seeing a team not as just a team, but as a response to other teams and stuff. It's wonderful.
And it was interesting to me, I will say that, because I'm like a history major from college and some of the stuff I write is history. And I think that that's just how history works too, you know, which is the United States became the way it became because of Japan and Germany and the Soviet Union. And they became the way they became because of Nazi Germany. And it just goes back and back and back, which is you're always in the middle of a whole chain of events. And you just see a little piece of it and think that's everything. Whereas you can just keep going back. It's like an infinite regress that everything is connected in this web and everyone's built to beat what came before, you know. And that meant a lot to me as a kid because the Pistons, their violence was it was inexplicable to us, you know. But then when you saw the Celtics and how it was very hard to beat the Celtics because they were such a big team, and such a big skilled team that they had to become that way to win a championship.
One of the points you make very eloquently in the book is concerns the fact that the true championship teams are built around superstar players, but they have additional critical players that sort of fit in perfectly in that. So there's this kind of tug of war between, you know, the superstar and the ego and the broader team.
Right.
There's another great passage in your book that I wanted to call out for the readers. And it's concerning Isaiah Thomas. So this is his rookie year. He was named Rookie of the Year. And you say, quote, "He studied Bird and Magic, the most successful players of the time, searching for the secret to winning. He decided it was sublimation. For a team to be successful, its best players have to sublimate their own talent, sacrifice playing time and point totals in pursuit of a balanced attack, which means less glory, less fame, less money for the individual." And yeah. I just wanted you to sort of...
Well, no, it's interesting because, you know, Isaiah Thomas could have led the league in everything, you know, and he realized at some point because of the Celtics that the well-balanced attack was going to be impossible to stop and then also give him a chance to score. And one of the things that was so great about the Celtics and really impossible to beat was they had like 9 legitimate NBA players. They had 2 starting teams. And yeah. their second team was arguably better than their first team because their second team had Vinnie Johnson and it had Dennis Rodman, John Sally, and Buddha Edwards all on the second team. So when a team like the Celtics would play them, their older players, because they were getting older, would have to come out and rest. And as soon as they did that, the second team of the Pistons would come on and run up the score. So then Larry Bird and everybody else had to come back into the game before they were ready and before they were rested. And it really made a difference when you got late in the season. And one of the things I know that Isaiah Thomas was very proud of, I think that not one of their players on their team like averaged 20 points a game. It was completely spread out. And one of the conflicts of that team is Adrian Dantley, who's a great player and a Hall of Fame player, wanted to score a lot of points. He led the leagues in points a few seasons before, and he was told that he had to sort of give some of his minutes and some of his time to Rodman because Rodman was the better defensive player. He was young, and Dantley made a big stink about it, wouldn't do it, and they finally traded Dantley the next season for Mark Aguirre, a childhood friend of Isaiah's, but not as good of a player as Dantley. But with the player who wasn't quite as good, they won the championships because he bought into the idea that everybody has to sublimate in order to win. Everybody has to sort of not shine as much. And in the way the Bulls had to do the same thing when Jordan finally realized that he needed his whole team to contribute for them to win. He wasn't going to win leading the league in points and scoring 60 points a game, even though he scored whatever 60 in the playoffs or whatever it was against the Celtics. They still lost. They needed a balanced attack. So that's where basketball is a great lesson for business and everything else, which is, you know, you got to kind of step back and let everybody else contribute if you want to win. And it doesn't always show in the record books, but what shows is the fact that that team won 2 championships, the Pistons, and they could have won 3. And some people would say they really did, except for a bad call against the Lakers. So it's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. And this idea of sublimating scoring, playing time, certainly was something Jordan bought into, right? That you cite one game, and I think there may have been more, even where he didn't even shoot in the first quarter.
Yeah,
you know, he had open shots that he passed just to get the team going.
Right, and in the season I write about 87-88, they didn't quite have the players, but they almost did. They were almost all there. They were just a piece or two away. And basically what the Pistons did with Jordan and the Jordan rules, one of the things they did is they got him to shoot all the time. They wanted him to shoot all the time early, then clamp down on him late. And when he was forced to go to other players, they were all cold because they hadn't shot all.
Okay.
But Jordan realized he's got to get other players into the action early. So when it comes down to crunch time, everybody's ready to make the big shot. And people who really were a fan of the Bulls, when they finally turned the corner, it's not even Jordan's shot we remember. It's the role players more. It's John Paxson hitting the big threes late against the Celtics, you know, in 1991 or whatever. And later it's Steve Kerr or Luke Longley, you know, or whoever, Bill Cartwright, you know, who suddenly is in the flow of the game. So the Bulls, it was exciting. Another thing that we miss in the game now is because of free agency. You know, these players like LeBron James has won championships with three teams. The players stayed together. The core of that team was together for almost their entire career. So you got to see them learn to play like a team and figure out the puzzle of how do you win in the NBA. And it's not how you win in college or in high school. It's a completely different thing. So that's like fascinating. And you kind of take it through the rest of your life, which is, how do you compete against really great opponents that might be better on paper, but you can beat by playing smarter?
All right. I got a sort of a multi-part question for you here. You have a passage in there where you say there are two units of NBA time. There is the season and there is the moment. The season is important, but it's made up of moments. When you're in the moment, there is no important or unimportant. There is no season. There's only the moment. So setting that aside for a sec, one of the things about your writing that startles me, in particular in the book about your father, is the amazing memory you seem to have of conversations and situations where, you know, if I'm thinking back that far, I sort of remember the event, but I certainly don't remember what everybody said to each other. Did you find when you're talking, you interviewed a lot of NBA players about this season and people who were on the various teams. Did they remember like every play the way, you know, like with a kind of precision of a moment, or are they searching back through their memory? What is an NBA player who's talking about a game that was 30X years ago? What can he tell you about that play, you know, in the third quarter when the thing happened?
People remember big moments in vivid, vivid detail. So, and I learned this when I was a kid, because my father used to get us into locker rooms where we'd meet old baseball players that were his heroes. And he would go up to them, guys like Bobby Richardson, who played for the Yankees, or Frank Thomas, or Hank Aaron, or even whoever it was. And he could ask them about specific at-bats. And if it was a big at-bat, they will tell you the pitches that they saw. Something about the intensity, they'll say, at first I saw a curveball and I let it go. And they remember beat by beat by beat. And anyone who's interviewed athletes knows that's how their memory is. Just like if you were in a car crash, you'd remember every moment of the car crash. So you might not remember the rest of the day. So the key to interviewing these people is you have to ask them very particular questions about particular moments. So if you set up what the game was and the ball came to them, they will remember, man. They will remember very specifically. I also like to ask them like about their first basket, because they all remember that. And that would trigger other memories, or their last game or whatever. You can't ask them what they thought of the season or whatever. But when you break down, you go ask Bill Laimbeer of the Pistons, who I interviewed, about game six in the 1987-88 NBA Finals and how he'd stopped Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and they called him for a foul and gave Kareem free throws at the side of the game. He remembers it and he remembers everything about it. So actually, when you're interviewing athletes, because they have such intense moments, they're great to interview because they do remember. Mm. And then you can check out a lot of what they say, because all this stuff is also on film.
Hmm. That's amazing. I think my favorite line from the book was something, I can't even remember who the player was. Someone was talking about if there's a steal or a dirty play and he's coming back down towards you and he says you pay him back with his own money.
Money.
Surely talking about Laimbeer. Because also, that's another thing. Like, Bill Laimbeer was kind of known as the dirtiest player in the game. He's kind of a rich kid. And he was, you know, you see him and he would be hitting people in the kidney away from the play and doing all these little things, really, to the Celtics. I mean, he had this, there's a thing where Robert Parrish,
the most hated man in New England by a long shot,
away from the play, just starts raining blows down on Laimbeer's head, and everybody thinks, oh yeah, of course, that's what he's got to do. So everybody I asked about Laimbeer, I think Charles Davis said to me that when you were on the ground after play, he'd stomp on you like you were bubble wrap. I mean, everybody, you know, so yes, that was asking about Laimbeer was always very entertaining to get the response.
So, Malcolm?
Sorry, I was going to say, just carrying on this idea of the sublimation of ego. And again, as a Celtics freak who I thought I had consumed every bit of content out there about the team, but you taught me several things. one of them is, you know, as Larry Bird, obviously, legendary trash talker, enormous ego. Def, maybe for your benefit, you know, he famously walked into the one of the early, if not the first, 3-point contests. Yeah. At the All-Star break, you know, so you're there with all the All-Star shooters, and he walked in and said, "Who's playing for second?"
Right. You know?
And then wanted wearing his warm-up jacket on.
Right.
But anyway, so a man with a giant ego. One of the things that sticks out, though, is how quick he was, and others, you know, these superstars, were to applaud excellence. Like you had a quote from Bird after he played played the Bulls in Jordan's rookie season. And, you know, I guess walking off the court, Bird said something like, "Oh, he's the best. I mean, he does things that nobody else does." So it's this weird tension between the ego, right? And the self-congratulation and the sublimation of that, and the identification of the other, right? The other team that's providing this excellence. Do you think that is a common tension across sports? Like, is that tension between the ego in the team, or the ego, you know, sort of focusing on the moment and just what's happening now versus the season? Do you think that that is kind of one of the reasons why we're so interested in sports?
Well, with the Jordan Bird thing, I always thought, though I didn't put it in because people would be pissed probably, that it was a little bit like John the Baptist and Jesus. He'd sort of say, someone even greater is coming after me, you know? And one of the reasons we love Larry Bird is he has the confidence to say that, to not say I'm better than Jordan. He knows the game better than anybody, and he's built himself as a player, and he never stops improving. That's one of the things that was admirable about Bird, which is he'd always try to learn new shots, even late in his career. And he recognized that Jordan was just doing something no one else had ever done and no one else could do. And I'm a believer that Jordan was, in my life, he's the best athlete in any sport I'd ever seen. And he just was different, I mean, and anybody who watched him play, and it wasn't just, you know, that he won, it was like how he looked doing it, his incredible sense of style, how cool he was. You know, so I think that Bird just recognized all that right away before other people. He recognized it before other people in the league because he really understood the game. And that's what great players will do. Great players who are really also into the game want that to happen. They want to play with those guys that are unique. One of the quotes from one of the old Celtics who retired was, "I wouldn't have retired if I knew I could have played with a guy like this." Like Larry Bird, just that they recognize it. And like the baser of human instincts is to try to cut down everybody in comparison to yourself. And Bird just was bigger than that. And he just said, you know, this guy's playing at a different level. As good as I am, there is another level. And the idea of that was kind of exhilarating. And you just don't see many people like that in any sport. And we all feel lucky to, you know, that we got to see it in the 90s with Michael Jordan and Bird among them.
Yeah.
Malcolm used to invite me over to his apartment during mid-90s NBA finals to watch Jordan. He's like,
well, that was a bit of the problem with the NBA, which is after Jordan retired and they broke up that team, it was like hard to, for a couple of years, I felt like I couldn't watch. It was like, yeah, how people probably felt about rock and roll when Elvis went into the army. It's like, what? What am I going to do? I mean, I'm going to watch Doris Day singing whatever, whatever. I mean, it's like a big letdown, you know, and you realize how, because they play a lot of games and you kind of need a rock star, a charisma person to kind of hold it all together if it's not your team. So, you know, if it's your team and your team is good, then you kind of get into it. But if it's not your team, why are you still watching? And it's to see something unique and to see something special. And that's why Jordan was so great for the NBA, because people watched who didn't, it wasn't their team, and they watched who, they didn't even care about basketball, yeah, you know? And Jordan, yeah, so it was an amazing thing. And it wasn't just that, I remember there's another great Bird quote where they said, Jordan is criticized for not being a team player, but he doesn't have a team.
Right.
That was like before they got the pieces. The first couple of years, they got Jordan because they had such a high draft pick and the team was a mess. And they slowly put the pieces in around him and he began to play with the team.
So you are there's a generosity of spirit in your writing about these guys. One of the things that was illuminating to me, I don't think I've ever read anybody write about Rodman so nicely, right? Like, obviously a talent, but I came out of reading your book thinking, oh my God, I think I had unidimensionalized him, just kind of a dick rebounder. And you made me realize that he was much more than that.
I was a Bulls fan and I loved Rodman. First of all, he's just another one of those guys who was like a rock star, who you couldn't keep your eyes off of him. He was super exciting. He brought his own energy into the game and he so badly wanted to succeed. And as a writer and somebody in the world, I really admired the idea that he sort of said, I'm not going to be a great scorer in this game and I'm not going to be a team leader. I'm going to find the thing that's important, really important, the most important thing, and that's undervalued, and I'm going to turn it into an art. It's sort of the garbage part of the game in a way. I'm going to turn rebounding into an art. And I'm going to try to be the greatest rebounder in the history of the game, even though I'm not the tallest guy. And he did that. And watching him rebound was so exciting that it made the game so much more exciting, because it made what was happening in the boards, which often was just a question of who's going to get possession, into, like I said, a game within a game. And if you remember those periods, like Rodman would go up and realizing he couldn't get the rebound, would tip the ball back up and do it over and over and over again, until the other guy finally just kind of quit and let him have it, you know. And rebounding, obviously, especially before the three-point shot, it meant that you had to only be half as effective at shooting if you got the ball back. And you'd watch times when the Pistons were on the offense and Rodman would get three or four offensive rebounds on a single possession. And even as a Bulls fan, you had to think, that's amazing and that's great, you know. And so, yeah, I always liked him. And the kind of flaky side of him to me was, well, he's an artist. I recognize that he's an artist, man. And we got to let our artists be a little bit crazy. I mean, Jordan was different. Obviously, he was the team leader. He was the face of the league. But Rodman was the wackadoo artist of the family. And he comes in with a giant fur hat and you just accept it because he's an artist.
Totally. One of my other favorite lines from the book, and I don't want to ruin it for readers because everyone should read it. You referred to a Pistons Bulls melee as like a fight from a Burt Reynolds movie. It's the best.
Because that's what I grew up with, you know?
Right.
And Hooper. Was it Hooper? Was that the one?
Yeah.
Where he hits Terry Bradshaw as hard as he can in the face. And Terry Bradshaw spits out a tooth and smiles. And Burt Reynolds says, I made a terrible mistake. So this is a kind of fight. I mean, everybody knows where a guy gets slid down the bar and somebody goes flying out the window and the stuntman's favorite fight. So that's what it was like. It's spread all over the entire floor.
All right, I am not going to ruin this one for the reader because it is its own art form in itself. I noticed your contribution to the Bob Project, or at least one of them in the book. Am I right? Was there only one, or were there more than one?
You know, my sensibility was so formed by Bob Dylan lyrics that it's
hard to say.
Yeah. So I'd have to. Yeah, I don't know. It's just like
we know one. We know there's one for sure. So readers, you got to look for a Bob Dylan quote in here. It'll jump out at you if you're paying attention. Malcolm, you got any other questions for Rich?
I do. I have. There's a little bit of perhaps breaking news in this book. So you were talking about the shot, right? So this is Jordan's shot at when he's playing for North Carolina, hitting the game winner versus Georgetown. And you may have seen the recent movie Air, right? Which there's kind of a very, very dramatic scene. Air, the greatest movie about a contract negotiation. but fascinating movie. And there's a very dramatic scene where Matt Damon's character dissects the play and looks at everyone's face and figures out that the Tar Heels had drawn up that play to go to Jordan. But you seem to indicate otherwise. So was that just the movie taking license?
You know what? I actually haven't seen the movie because I didn't want anything else in my head when I was writing this book. And also the movie came out a little later. I was already well along. So, but I will now watch it. Now it's safe to watch it. But I will say that that play was not drawn up for Jordan. Jordan was an option on the play, which is, this is, you know, like any good coach, he's not going to, you know, he's not going to be able to put himself in the game again. This is the last instructions he give. And you have the North Carolina team had great players. I mean, it had James Worthy and Sam Perkins. So a Hall of Famer and an all-star, and Jordan was a freshman. So as good as Jordan was, he wasn't the first option on that team at all. So basically the fact is Jordan was often open because the defense wasn't covering him as tightly as they were the team's go-to players. So it's sort of like work the ball and get it to one of these guys. And if they're covered, look for Jordan because he's been open. Yeah. And then Jordan turned and said, if you get me the ball, I will make the shot.
Yeah.
So it's like more, it says more, sort of say it was drawn up for Jordan, takes a little bit of the credit away from what a great coach Dean Smith was, because Dean Smith was about, this is what you do in each possible scenario. And if it looks like we have no outlet, this is what you do. And then Jordan hit the shot and his whole life changed.
I'm stirring the pot a little bit. When you watch the movie, you'll see the main point they're trying to make is Jordan wanted the ball.
Yeah, but any great player is going to want the ball. And I remember like my Bears book about the Chicago Bears, Doug Plank, who was a great safety for the Bears and influences everything I think about sports, because he made me see it differently. Because he was a safety. He's talking about football players. He said, you see some guys and they look unbelievable, but you put them in equipment and they just don't want to hit anybody. And other guys, you look at them and you think, no way, not this guy. And you put them in equipment and they're a monster. You know, and his idea is the great players always want the ball. So I imagine that James Worthy wanted the ball. Sam Perkins wanted the ball, you know, and maybe they would have made I mean, James Worthy was a great, great basketball player. So the fact is, though, that was a lesson on team basketball, because Dean Smith really played team basketball within his system, which kept Jordan down a little, which is why people didn't see what a great individual talent he was. But that system meant they won the national championship because they have three legitimate superstars and two very other good players on that team. And Dean Smith was going to use all of them and then kind of have Jordan as kind of the ace in the hole, which is Dean Smith knew how good, and his teammates knew how good Jordan was, even if the rest of the world didn't. And he thought, you know, in the key moment, we go to this guy who no one's thinking, and he hits the big shot, you know, and we win the game.
My final, this isn't so much a question, but just a comment and a thank you, really, Rich, because there's two Celtics details in the book, and I'm sure for everyone out there who follow other teams, you'll find other examples of this. But number one is Larry Bird had never been to a pro basketball game until he played in one.
Yeah.
and the second was Kevin McHale didn't even know he got drafted.
Yeah. when somebody said to him, congratulations, he thought it was something about a fraternity. The University of Minnesota thought it was a fraternity thing. And Bird, what I like is they would get in a car and they would drive and have to get a signal to listen to the Cubs games. That's all they could get because the Cubs were on, you know, WGN or WGN radio or whatever. So he could hear the Cubs. So it's amazing. Like somebody like Larry Bird just comes out kind of out of nowhere. Although the people that know basketball, and of course we all, I watched anyway, him play at Indiana State. But it's interesting because in the championship, the NCAA final where Bird and Magic first play each other, which is going to be the defining matchup for several years. It's, you know, Indiana, Michigan. You always think University of Michigan and Indiana University, two of the basketball powerhouses. And it's Indiana State and Michigan State.
Yeah.
Wow, so on the to close out here, you just did make the point that every great player wants the ball. But one of the things I underlined from the book, which I think is a great lesson in life, too. Joey talks about this all the time. You're talking about Isaiah, and you said he loved to pass because he knew the ball would come back.
Yeah.
It's like a lot of stuff. One of the great things about reading your stuff, Rich, is you're always talking about something bigger than the thing you're talking about. And that to me is like, that one jumped out at me. It's like, you know, here's how you want to be great, right? Don't be a fucking ball hog, right? Give it.
Right.
Share the ball and pass it because it's going to come back to you. If you don't pass it, you're never getting a pass.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. And, you know, that's the great thing about sports, which is in my life, all the lessons from sports apply to life, man, because it's all the same thing. And that is also something I learned from Bob Dylan, whose lyrics are so much about what they're not about, you know? So I think that, you know, that's the really inspiring thing is because there are these four great teams and we all rank them basketball people, not just as four of the great dynasties, but the Pistons never get their due because the Pistons sublimated and Isaiah Thomas didn't score 40 points a game, though he surely could have. And Isaiah Thomas was always a special kind of hero to me because he's from Chicago. I'd seen him play when he was in high school and in college. And because in relative NBA terms, he was short. And being a short person, I always found that I always thought like players who are short in the NBA, wasn't really short by normal standards, but by NBA standards, they have to be not just as good, they have to be better. Mm-hmm. You know, so if you see it, you'll see mediocre 7'2" players in the NBA. You don't see anyone under 6 feet tall who's mediocre. They're all great.
Mm-hmm. Rich Cohen. Always a pleasure to talk. Always a pleasure to read. Listeners,
thanks,
When the Game Was War, it's a fantastic book. Oh, I told Rich this last week. I didn't even know who won this season when I started reading this book. And I read it like a thriller. I was like, you know what? I could go to Google right now and just figure it out because he's obviously going to be foreshadowing some stuff, but very lightly, very deftly. And I was like, you know what I'm going to do? I'm just going to read this and let it be a surprise. And, you know, for the non-super basketball fan like me, it was great. It was a great book for not knowing. It was totally like a thriller.
Thank you.
Thanks, dude.
Thanks
Rich.
Can't wait for the next one.
Thank you.
Rich Cohen. He is, in my opinion, and I mean this sincerely, the best writer of all time, at least is from where I sit. And what a great interview. Wow.
Yeah. I mean, not only a fantastic writer who talks about the big picture, but just sentence to sentence, phrase to phrase. I mean, just gripping. Really, really enjoyed talking with him. He's got a really sort of deep sense, I think, of and love of the game. You know what I mean? I think it comes from a fan's point of view for sure.
Yeah, and you know what you can tell from he talks about basketball a bunch in The Adventures of Herbie Cohen because his father was a coach, but also you know, he's, like I said, he's written about football, baseball, hockey. He's got this ability to draw the lessons out of any situation. And, you know, it's quite clearly he sees sport as a metaphor for life. Yes. And is able to tell us these stories of these great athletes, but also draw out for the rest of us what it should mean to you. Right. What Bird was doing, what Jordan was doing, what Magic was doing, what it means to how to live a life. And he said that at the end. I was going to mention it and it slipped my mind. To me, in Tickled, I was like, Harry Potter, it was that for me. I read it with Marguerite. We read the 7 books in a straight back to back to back to back. And I quote her all throughout Tickled, not because, you know, to me, Harry Potter is the be all end all, but because right when I was going to write the book, I was like, oh my God, whatever it is I want to make a point about, J.K. Rowling has made that point in Harry Potter, just like he said about Dylan. Right. There's some artists who are so complete. Right. And they have to have an extended career. But I was like, if I want to draw a lesson about anything, it's in there somewhere. I'll be able to find it.
Yeah. I mean, a point you make on this very podcast is that, you know, there are many different kinds of tickles, but they all lead to the same place. Right. So whether it's Harry Potter or, you know, mid-80s basketball or whatever it is, it sort of gets back to the same thing.
Right, which is the one. So here we go. Here is, I've got one for you. And this isn't a classic one that from the ones I talked to with Matt about where we find a hidden meaning in a word. I just read this passage from Ramesh Balsekar that had the greatest use of wordplay that I've read in a while. Rich Cohen, not included because he's the greatest writer I've ever read. So here we go. So he's talking about how any effort that we make towards achieving an awakening or enlightenment is going to be doomed to some kind of failure because the idea that you are a thing is the problem, right? Mm-hmm. So if you make effort, and he says here, all efforts made by a supposed entity can only lead to frustration. It is only the effortless effort, which is passive witnessing, along the pathless path, which is pure understanding without a me as the comprehender, which can lead to the goalless goal. That which has always been here and now. And Rich talks about this in the book, right? He says there's a season and there's a moment, but a season's made up of moments. So it's only the effortless effort along the pathless path which can lead to the goalless goal. That's all you need to do. Just relax.
That's right. And I actually think that connects back to one of the first topics we talked about with Rich, which was kind of why does it seem like the NBA has lost its magic, right? And just to recap that, like, basically everyone's hucking up 3-pointers and they go in and they don't. And it seems, as he put it, like a carnival game. Whereas when you saw those great teams of the 80s, you know, again in basketball or in many other sports, right? It's that complete and total focus of on the present, of being in the moment, right? Mm-hmm. He had a great quote from Jordan about hitting the shot, and he said, "Yeah, when you're in the moment, you can see the whole floor."
You right.
Know? So there you go.
Also, he had a great line I forgot to read about the Celtics, and I knew you would enjoy it. He said, this team was not tempted by rim-rattling jam. Their game was quiet. Each play unfolded like a maze. Each maze ended at the basket.
Yes. Wonderful.
All right. And another one. To close this out here, I've been reading Balsekar for a couple weeks. So here's a quote here where he's talking about the fact that nothing is separate. Everything is connected. The idea that you think you can pull a player or an event out of your own life and sort of isolate it is illusory, right? Nothing can be extracted from the everything that is now, right? It's only conceptually where you can pull a thing out and say, well, I did this and he did that. Everything is connected. And there's this beautiful line or passage from Balsakar. And he goes, a world wherein all events are clearly interdependent, an immense complexity of subtly balanced relationships, which, like an endless knot, has no loose end from which it can be untangled and put in supposed order. It is quite ridiculous for man to consider this world as something outside of himself, as something he can control from without, with his roots established outside the world which he is considering. Man and nature are one phenomenon, not two. At sports, that's the great teams, right?
If a player those are great moments.
Right? If a player pulls out and starts playing selfishly, then he's not, the team isn't going to succeed. And Rich just told us all about that. But everything is connected, people. Thanks for listening. And thanks for listening. Thanks, Malcolm, for guest hosting. We think this is already a success, so you'll be hearing from him again. We'll be back with you next week.
Nice.
You've been listening to How to Tickle Yourself with your host, Duff McDonald, and me, Joey of Rockledge. You can help us by liking, subscribing, and sharing this podcast with others. You can talk to us and see what else is happening on Instagram and Facebook at How to Tickle Yourself. This program was recorded in Studio B of the historic Rockledge Recording Studio. Right here, right now, our original 16-part theme music was written and recorded by the legendary Paul Reddick and Kyle Ferguson of the Sidemen, with Steve Mariner on bass and drums and in the mixing room. This podcast is produced and distributed by Stork Media. Our editor is Oscar Desiderio. Our producers are Kristen Verbitsky and Chuck Babella. For more information, visit storicmedia.com. That's storicmedia.com.